Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
At the St. Louis International Film Festival, Justin L. Fisher debuted his documentary called Gateway Sound. The original intent was to document the history of recording studios in St. Louis, and then it got bigger. Hi, I'm Ryan Recker. Today's KMOX Profile is with Justin L. Fisher, audio engineer, producer, musician, and chief engineer at Smithley Productions.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Do you go by your middle initial? Do you say Justin L. Fisher?
I don't ever call myself Justin L. Fisher. I put that there for credit reasons.
Okay.
Because there's another Justin Fisher out there. He's the bass player for the band Nerf Herder. And so there's only a handful. When I say handful, I mean two sites to track credits for engineers and producers. And one's AllMusic and one is Discogs. Discogs is like really iffy. In AllMusic, there's no way to correct the information. Really. So
does it pull from other sites?
Kind of, yeah. And so the problem is, you know, you have Justin Fisher here, Justin Fisher here, and some of his credits are in my stuff, and some of my credits are in his stuff, and it's just a big mishmash. So if you look at allmusic.com, either it looks like I did a bunch of Nerf Herder stuff, or the guy from Nerf Herder has all my work.
Yeah.
So
and that's why you had to
I started putting my middle initial in to kind of separate myself from...
So that other Justin was there first? It's like they planted the flag on the moon.
Yeah, so a little bit.
There's no turning around for something like that.
Well, and the thing is, too, is with the film and with IMDb and stuff, too, there's a bunch of Justin Fishers in film work. So,
you are an audio engineer, producer, musician.
Correct. Not so great a musician. But
what do you play?
I play guitar.
Oh, okay.
Poorly.
Do you have a lot of pride in the type of guitar you play?
No.
No allegiance to any particular brand?
Well, oh, like actual guitars?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a Gibson fan through and through. Yeah.
Okay.
I've never really gotten into Fender stuff.
No.
It's not my sound, and the feel of it I don't really care for, but I've always been a Les Paul guy.
Who's your favorite guitarist?
Ooh, that's a multifaceted question because it could be, you know, depending on style. You know, I'm going to give a really lame answer, and that is my favorite guitar player would be someone who got me into playing guitar, which would be Kurt Cobain.
Oh, okay.
And he's by no means a great guitar player from a technical standpoint, but that's really Nirvana is what made me start playing. So I guess I would have to give credit where credit's due.
I thought you were going to say Prince or something like that. He's one of those underrated guitar players.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, like you can't, it's like what's your favorite song, you know, or what's your favorite movie? Well, there's so many criteria out there. It's like, it's hard to make that decision and narrow it down.
So you being an audio engineer, I just adjusted the mic pods slightly and you took notice of that. Do you always pay attention to things like that?
It's movies, especially, you know, when I'm watching a movie and I'm, that microphone's not plugged in or, you know, that stuff drives me nuts when there's on-camera performances.
What happens when you see one of those microphones dip into the shot like you're watching TV?
Well, you know, luckily these days you almost never see that because, you know, a lot of things are shot in 4K now.
Mm-hmm.
So that stuff's easier to crop in and get rid of that kind of stuff. So you don't really see that too much anymore.
Tricky. There's a lot of things that could hide the blemishes of the mistakes of the past.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. For better or worse, George Lucas.
And you also have on your t-shirt is the headphones.
Yeah, well, this is actually, I teach over at Webster University.
Yeah.
So every year we hold a mini audio engineering society convention.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, and it's, the St. Louis, or the, I'm sorry, the Central Region Audio Student Summit.
Yeah.
CRASS. Mm-hmm. So they, we bring in people from all over the region to do talks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty cool event.
Yeah. What are the things the kids are interested in learning?
Well, I mean, I don't think things have changed that much. It's, mm-hmm. you know, so many people get into recording for music, mm-hmm. you know, and I have a lot of interns that come through the studio, and a lot of people just want to learn how to record music and want to learn how to produce bands and all that stuff. So that's the primary reason. The sad thing is the jobs are few and far between. Mm. So they might get into it for one reason and then end up shifting their career path. I mean, there's tons of opportunities in other things like, you know, live sound or post-production for film and TV. Mm-hmm. But the music thing is just not what it used to be.
Yeah.
You know,
is it, you were doing the research for your documentary that came out, Gateway Sound. One of the things I read that surprised you was you were worried that when you went to talk to some of these production houses, you would go in there and they would only tell you about how they're about ready to lock the doors up and call it quits. But you were kind of surprised. There's a lot of them that were just chugging along, maybe not as strong as they used to, but they're still finding ways in the industry to be viable.
Yeah, it's just different now.
Mm-hmm.
They might not be doing the exact same that they were 10, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. but, you know, a lot of places just found different methods. I went down to Memphis at Sam Phillips, mm-hmm. and they kind of found a revitalized niche in like Americana music,
mm-hmm.
and doing vinyl. Jeff Powell down there is doing, he's like backlogged like months and months because the vinyl thing has exploded.
Yeah.
And he's doing a ton of it.
What's the perfect recording studio setup for you? Do you have a preference? Do you prefer walking in and seeing, you know, old school equipment and, you know, cigarette, you know, like the little trays where there's a bunch of like cigarette butts in there and you're like, yeah, this guy knows what he's doing? Or do you prefer like the modern studios where all the equipment's digital and there's a bunch of lights and everything's set up perfectly?
I'm right down the middle.
Hmm.
Because with the older analog gear comes maintenance issues and comes time,
mm-hmm.
because if we're recording to tape, there's a, you know, you got to sit there and wait for it to rewind.
Record to tape. You don't hear that anymore.
it's still out there. Not many people do it. There's an expense, you know, a reel of tape now costs you $350.
Ooh, really?
Yeah. And that's like 15 minutes of recording. So that's kind of gone by the wayside for most places, but you know, the big analog consoles and still, are still a maintenance nightmare,
yeah.
a lot of times. And people don't, you know, have techs in their studios anymore. So I love a hybrid approach where I've got a digital on the record side and actually digital on the console side, but all my other gear is analog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to kind of have the best of both worlds.
Yeah. How did you learn to do the things you're doing?
Trial and error,
mm-hmm.
I guess, for a good portion of it. But I went to school, too. I went to Webster, mm-hmm. here in St. Louis, got a 4-year degree in audio. But this field is like you never stop learning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never pretend that I'll be an expert ever. But the beginning of it was wanting to record my own band.
Yeah.
You know, and started out on cassette and I graduated. It's kind of embarrassing, but I graduated. Well, a friend of mine went to audio school and he had his audio books. And when he graduated, he gave them to me.
Uh-huh.
So I studied my butt off,
mm-hmm.
and I was looking at this chart of like frequency response and saw that the frequency response of VHS, mm-hmm. is significantly better than cassette. So I went out and bought myself a second VCR and I did like sound on sound kind of overdubbing between two VCRs.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, then I eventually got a computer and the sky was the limit.
So you were trying to sync two VHS recorders to make like a multi-track?
No, I would literally like record on one and then record on the second one over the existing tape. So I would like be bouncing back and forth from deck to deck,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of worked, you know.
You got to name that technique. That's the first time I've ever heard
well,
something like
I'm
that.
Just waiting for like the what is vintage now is going to be like old crappy digital technology, you know, eventually.
I only record on the mini disc. Something like that. We continue with Justin L. Fisher, audio engineer, producer, musician, also chief engineer at Smithley Productions here in St. Louis, talking about not only his time working inside the studio, but his new documentary that debuted at the St. Louis International Film Festival. Next on KMOX Profiles.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Hi, I'm your host, Ryan Recker. We're profiling today Justin L. Fisher, who put a documentary out, debuted just recently at the St. Louis International Film Festival. You may have seen it. It's called Gateway Sound. When I look at some of the different professions out there where people will call you, they'll be like, hey, my computer's broken. If you're a computer guy, everyone calls you. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with my car. If you're a car guy, everyone calls you. We're starting to see a pretty big influx of people building home studios. So I got to imagine someone wants to make a recording space for a podcast, or they just want to record themselves fiddling on the guitar. You're probably in demand where they ask you your opinion on, hey, how do I set this up and what do I do?
A bit, yeah. I do get a lot of calls from people that are wanting to ask advice on what microphones to buy, what interfaces to buy and all that stuff. So it happens pretty frequently, and you know, I'm fine with that. I'm not going to bemoan like lost work because I fully understand how the business is now. Yeah. So I don't go, oh, why don't you just come in and we'll make it better.
Yeah.
You know?
I know how that works. Well, I have a home studio too. I record some stuff at the house if I need to record interviews or anything like that. And sometimes I'll do these little videos for my fantasy hockey league, which is kind of dorky, but it's kind of fun to add that extra moment. But it's amazing how the prices really come down on a lot of this equipment. Before, you know, when I was in college, it was a big deal if you can afford to buy the Adobe software to get the onto your computer. Now today, it seems like you can buy some of the most, you know, even though it's really low quality, but you can put a rig in your house for like $150 if you really wanted to and just get a microphone and interface that way.
Yeah.
And for the most part, you know, people will still listen to it. It won't be unlistenable.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like you're recording on a Fisher Price little recorder that you had as a kid or anything like that.
Yep.
So the price, as it continues to come down, I think has grabbed a lot of people interested into that field.
Yeah. The home studios are nothing new. You know, they've been around since Les Paul.
Yeah.
And there's nothing we can do to change that. But the quality has definitely increased significantly.
Mm-hmm.
And which is great because it kind of gives me an opportunity to go back and forth with demos on bands, you know, and they can bring me something that I can actually hear rather than, oh, we recorded this on a cassette during band practice in the basement. And I'm like, I can kind of make out what the guitar is doing, but mostly I hear snare drum.
Yeah.
So in that respect, it's great, you know, because it gives us a chance to communicate a little bit better. Mm. But I've had a lot of bands that I've actually kind of done a back and forth with where they'll record a little bit in the studio and then a little bit at home. And it saves them time and money and it makes the whole process more efficient.
With your documentary Gateway Sound, when you walk into a recording studio, what's the first thing you look for?
Well, I'm a gear nerd, so I'm usually looking at the gear first, but also kind of like listening to what the room sounds like, because every room is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of like talking in the space and assessing what it sounds like. And I you know, I love doing that and exploring different acoustic spaces. It's really cool.
That is pretty neat. Do you get that feel when you're around other audio people all the time? It's just like, this is awesome.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because just last night I was at an audio engineering society meeting. So the audio community in St. Louis is pretty tight-knit group. Mm-hmm. You know, pretty much everybody knows everybody. So there's no like competition between studios because we're all friends, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get together once every other month and, you know, eat and drink beer and talk nerdy audio stuff.
Audio, so. Yeah. Audio trade secrets and things.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty cool. So yeah, that's always exciting. We always have a lot of fun doing that kind of stuff.
So that probably helped you when you were recording Gateway Sound. You had the ability to just make a phone call and say, hey, can I talk to you about something? And you can just go and do it.
Yeah, and there's a number of people in that group that are in the film as well. So
how long did it take for you to film that?
4 years. Well, not film it for four. I was filming it for about three, but the whole process was about 4 years.
And it kept getting longer. You were originally going to make it like a half hour or something. You stretched it out.
Well, it was at the beginning, I didn't quite want to limit myself, but I had a guess on like what it was going to be. But I thought to myself, I'm going to let the creative process kind of dictate itself. So I didn't want to put any kind of barriers there for myself.
Yeah. You want to be able to tell the story no matter how long it takes,
exactly.
I guess.
Yep.
So you have that ability when you're the one putting it together. Where did you learn your video skills?
Advice from friends, lynda.com.
You know, it's amazing. If you can understand the audio side, a lot of those skills are transferable.
Totally. Yes. On the editing.
Yeah, on the
editing. You know, the shooting, not so much. I am horrible at lighting. And I still look at some of the... I didn't shoot many scenes, but I shot a couple just because I had to travel by myself or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I still look at certain scenes and I'm like, ugh, I wish I could have made that better. But it's probably only something I'm going to notice. You know, most people won't notice.
Well, 4 years could turn to six before you know. Overall, what was the reaction when you showed Gateway Sound?
Really positive. I mean, not just from people like in the audio business, but musicians and people that weren't even in the business at all. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, I had no idea about this, or I didn't know that this was an issue, or I didn't know the music business was kind of working in this way. You know, so everybody, I hope and I think, learned something. They had some sort of takeaway from it. So,
yeah, you always hope that. You know, someone will be able to walk away with, yeah, I really like that.
Yeah, otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, you could do it for your own sake.
Yeah, but then what's my wife would have killed me if I was just doing it for me.
What's the support of the wife during that process? Was she thinking to herself, you're always working on that? Or was she getting frustrated ever at any points?
But
you had this dream of putting it together.
Yeah, she was extremely supportive. But at the same time, I would try my best to work really late at night. Mm-hmm. So for about a year, there were many nights where I was up till 3-4 in the morning working on it because I didn't want to take time away from the family if I could avoid it.
Yeah.
So, you know, the shooting stuff, obviously, it happens when it happens. But all the editing I tried to get done, you know, in other hours.
Yeah. What do you think's changed the most in the industry since when you first started paying attention?
I mean, obviously the way music's distributed, you know, I think that the vast majority of people listen to music on their phone and they listen to it via streaming services for the most part. I mean, even we saw a huge shift when we went from CDs to downloads on iTunes. And even now that is kind of gone by the wayside. Mm-hmm. Nobody's really downloading music as much anymore.
Yeah.
Why would they when you can have Spotify or Pandora and just you have access to literally everything?
Yeah.
So it's hard to say what's next. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't see streaming going anywhere for a long time.
Yeah. The idea of his documentary was to film the history of recording studios in St. Louis, and then it got bigger. Justin L. Fisher is his name. Gateway Sound is the documentary. More with him next on KMOX Profiles.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This year at the St. Louis International Film Festival, Justin L. Fisher debuted his documentary, Gateway Sound, a look inside the recording studios of St. Louis, and then it expanded outward. We learn more about him as chief engineer of Smithley Productions, also a producer and musician in the area, here on KMOX Profiles. When the students that come into the college are interested, is it primarily on the back end of recording, or do you actually get musicians that want to try to make it as a professional musician?
I would say mostly on the technical end.
Yeah. So no SoundCloud rappers.
Well, there's some of those too. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a new thing.
Some people want to kind of get into it to learn how to make beats and stuff. And we're like, well, you're not really in the right place to do that.
Yeah.
But that definitely happens as well.
Oh, I see. You know, when I look at different documentaries like this in Gateway Sound, originally your scope was to talk to the people around the St. Louis region. Why did you decide to expand out and try to look at other recording studios?
Well, I kind of came to the realization that the market was too small in terms of viewership.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I want to do anything or go anywhere with this film, well, I can't really, nobody outside of the St. Louis region is going to be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, well, why am I limiting myself to just this space? Not to mention, I've got a lot of friends that are, you know, in the business and, you know, fairly prominent people in the business. And so I started reaching out to those people and everybody was really receptive to it. So
yeah.
I think it turned out as a much better product. And, you know, there's always that factor of when you have something to show people, some sort of art or media, people will latch onto it a lot better if they see someone or hear someone they know,
yeah,
you know, or that's popular or famous or whatever. So I think that I hate to put it that way, but the little bit of star power doesn't hurt.
You've been included with some popular musicians over the years. You've actually, you know, between recording or mixing or, you know, when you put the credits up on your website, when I checked it out and there's a couple of names that popped up. When you're in a studio and there's like a well-known musician that walks in, is it different? Is there a different feel for you than when, you know, maybe someone walks in that you really are not familiar with their work?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I mean, I try and treat people all equal. I wouldn't, you know, if like Carrie Underwood was in the studio, I didn't like treat her any differently than, you know, whoever's coming in to make a demo.
Yeah.
You know?
So you don't feel like, okay, it's Carrie Underwood. I better not mess this up. So you're like, you're afraid you're going to upset anyone.
I try not to think about that too much, but
you just be you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause if you start thinking about it, then you will mess something up. But, yeah, I mean, I guess from my perspective, doing audio, doing recording is just as much a kind of connecting with people type job than it is making things sound good.
Hmm.
Because if they're not comfortable, nothing's going to sound good.
Yeah.
And that's really what my job is making people comfortable and deliver a good performance.
So Brian McKnight, you were recording and he did, was that the soundtrack for Polar Express?
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
2005,
yeah,
it says.
That movie came out a while ago.
Where'd you even record that one?
That was at Smithley, where I work.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Kelly Pickler was in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
You also had on there Keith Urban, Carrie Underwood, the fighter, an assistant engineer on something like that.
Yep.
When you get some of these really popular names, you find that more people stack themselves into the recording studio because they want to witness it. Like, is there a star power factor?
You mean like,
you're like all of a sudden
hangers on?
Yeah, hangers on. Oh, yeah, you can record anyone, and you could just be the regular people that are there to do the job. But then when you bring a Keith Urban in or something like that, next thing you know, it's like everyone wants to witness something like that.
No, we put the kibosh on that pretty
That's
quick.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah,
probably for the best.
Lock things down a little bit.
Yeah. Did you do some things for Pixar Disney?
Yeah, a bunch of stuff. They're a good client of ours. So
voices for some of their characters.
Yeah. And so Phyllis Smith, who's on The Office, she did the voice of Sadness for Inside Out.
Mm-hmm.
So we did all the voices for the video game Disney Infinity, which Sadness is a character in that game. So we did all the voices of her for that.
Did she grow up in this area?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember.
Yep, her and Jenna Fisher are both from Missouri.
That is cool. I've seen photos and people talking about it when she makes her rounds, which is pretty neat.
Yep, she's a lovely person.
The video game recording, that is something new, too, when you see the amount of production that goes into the audio side in video games.
Yep.
Before, I don't know if you played video games when you were younger. It was a lot more simplistic than PlayStation comes out, they start putting these things on disc, and now there's storylines, and there's soundtracks, and there's audio tracks. Yeah. It's, like, you know, Nintendo, they couldn't fit those things on a cartridge. You know, you had the original, and that was the most. It was, like, mind-blowing.
It's one of my favorite games.
Yeah, but that little bit of audio was like, whoa. Next thing you know, you're putting things on a disc. You can get like 8 or 9 discs or whatever in some of these larger games, but they have all of these voice tracks on them, which was different
too.
Well,
the video game industry now is larger than both the music industry and the film industry combined.
Yeah.
By a large amount. The gaming industry in terms of jobs and in terms of amount of work is huge.
Yeah.
So these places have big, huge audio departments and motion capture departments and all the stuff that brings it all together.
Documentary-wise, you have recorded sound for some documentary. Those mostly like voiceovers?
I do a lot of audio for film.
That's really neat. Yeah. That's got to be fun, too. Is that just like they show in the movies or if when you ever watch like a television show, it's just a booth and there's a guy standing in there and he's got a... You know, the paper's in front of them, behind the glass, and there's some audio engineers watching from the other side. And it's, can you read that again a little bit differently? And is that basically what your day is like?
I don't do a ton of ADR work and things like that just because most of the stuff I get, they're smaller independent films. Mm-hmm. So all the production audio kind of is what it is. So I'm mostly doing mixing and like some Foley work, so creating different sound effects and things like that, and sound design work.
Mm-hmm.
So my work is pretty much all on the post end.
Yeah, I get that. You know, when people think about audio mixing today, what are some of the misconceptions do you think that people have that they've seen from movies or televisions?
Well, that pretty much anything can be fixed and that some people are better musicians and performers than they actually are too. But
so like
those
on
things
a,
go hand in hand, obviously.
So like on a NCIS or whatever, they'll say, hold on a second.
Yeah. I can enhance.
I'll isolate this audio. Click, and it's done.
Yeah, that is, don't get me started on that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the people that work with Photoshop every day, too, are like kind of pulling their hair out about that stuff, too. Actually, there's something called the CSI effect, which has drastically changed the public's perception of what can be done to audio, video, and photography.
Mm-hmm.
Because of those shows.
Oh, and they make it look so easy.
Yeah. Well, I get a lot of people that come into the studio and they're like, hey, I need a karaoke version of this song. Can you pull the vocals out for me? And they think that I can instantly do that. And I have to explain to them, well, it's kind of like when you bake a cake. And once you've baked the cake, I can't pull the flour out.
Yeah.
It's done. It's put together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have a lot of those kind of misconceptions.
It's a good way to put it, actually. I really like that analogy.
Yeah, but mostly it's when people think about making a song or like a hit record, and they don't realize not only the amount of work that goes into it to get it there, but also so much of that is performance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a good song performed well with good instruments and a good arrangement, it's not going to be a good song, no matter what you do to it. But there's still a lot of work that goes into it. There's just, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's so many facets to making a good recording.
Yeah.
You know, there's not, you can't narrow it down to a couple things.
We continue one last time with Justin L. Fisher, chief engineer at Smithley Productions, also his new documentary talking about Gateway Sound and maybe the new working title coming up on KMOX Profiles.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
I am your host, Ryan Recker. We continue one last time with our guest today, Justin L. Fisher, who debuted his documentary at the St. Louis International Film Festival just this year, looking at some of the recording studios inside the St. Louis region. You ever use Auto-Tune?
Yeah, you kind of have to sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Is Auto-Tune a physical standalone device, or is that something you use?
It used to be.
Yeah, but not anymore.
But now it's all in the software now.
Yeah. What's your favorite software to use?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't really have a favorite per se, but...
You said you use Pro Tools?
Yeah, that's kind of my tool.
Yeah.
No pun intended, but, you know, it's everything's just a tool. And yes. I don't want to like glorify any one thing and say, oh, this is what makes the record sound great, mm-hmm. because it's experience that is what makes the record sound great.
Yeah.
Not any specific tool. It helps.
What drives you nuts in the industry? Is there anything that you start seeing in trends that every time you look at that, you cringe?
Yeah. So I was, this is kind of a weird thing to bring up, but I was listening to the new, it's not new, it's from 2010, but Crash Test Dummies put out a record. And I used to love them, and they put out a record, the last record they put out. And I listened to it, and I was just, like, appalled at how it sounded. It was way over-compressed and sounded crunchy and just, like, it was mixed like a rock record, like a hard rock record. And that really bothers me. Like, the thought that everything has to sound so, you know, up front and just compressed to heck and... It doesn't always work for everything. Yeah. And I go back and I listen to, you know, God Shuffled His Feet from what, 1994 or 3 or something like that. And it's an amazing sounding record. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, just the latest example of that I can think of. But that happens so many times where you listen to records now compared to records 20 years ago, and they just don't sound as good.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think mostly because they're producing it in a way that they know the consumption will be different, or do you just think maybe the level of, you know, the standard has been lowered?
All of those things.
Yeah, that could be part of it, too.
Yeah, well, you know, the loudness war kind of affected that, too, in terms of just trying to get
the
things
loudness
to,
war.
To be as slammed as they possibly can, and that definitely didn't help.
Yeah,
but the funny thing is it doesn't really matter anymore, because of streaming and Spotify, YouTube, Pandora. All those companies have basically not really agreed on a standard, but almost to where things don't have to be super super loud anymore. So there's a little more leeway.
Just like a lot of the filmmakers said, you ruin the experience by watching this on your phone. And when you look at the way things are compressed in order to save bandwidth, and they think, okay, it's just going to be saved as an MP3 anyway, so why do I have to make this giant track sound good like they're listening to it in their on headphones off of a, you know, their stereo player or whatever it is. What happens next with Gateway Sound in your documentary? Do you start looking at different ways to distribute it?
Yeah, well, the title changes, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because, you know, like we were saying earlier, with the not being a St. Louis film, the Gateway connotation kind of makes people think that.
Yeah.
So that's, once it gets picked up for distribution, most likely the title's going to change. But we're talking with a distributor right now and kind of, you know, giving it to the lawyer, so
it's
very likely within a number of months it'll be out for streaming
all
kinds of different platforms.
Yeah, there's been some pretty good documentaries lately that have come out of the St. Louis region. One I just watched was the one about Keishi, that was a really cool one, and they sell those at the different shops. I bought it at a video game shop in St. Charles. I saw it at the counter. It's like, I'll pick that up. Why not? So those the physical copies get around here. People like to support the local things in the community.
Yeah.
That's a great thing that St. Louis is, I think, known for. They like to support the St. Louis-y things.
Yeah, I didn't really anticipate doing physical copies because there's just like so much extra that goes into that, expenses and stuff.
Oh,
so
sure.
It'll probably just be streaming, most likely.
Yeah. So when you have these big people that distribute, like the Netflix and the Amazons and things like that, is that like, what's the gold standard for trying to distribute? Is it trying to get on a platform like that?
I think everybody kind of wants to be on Netflix. That's the goal, because so many people have it. And out of all streaming services, that's kind of like the biggest one. But you know, at the same time, a lot of people have Amazon Prime.
Wow, I know.
And a lot of people can access Amazon Prime. So there's that. There's iTunes. There's like YouTube Red. And,
sure.
You know, all those other avenues. So with any luck, it'll be on all of those things.
Yeah. Whenever you look at a picture of a studio, Like I look at the some of them that were put inside of this St. Louis Magazine article that they wrote with you after the trailer, and then there was the film festival that just was this past weekend.
Yep.
And I look at some of these studios, and everything's so fancy. Everything looks so nice. It's funny because some of the places I've worked in radio look like it's a closet. And some of these places are just so nice. There's such a wide variety of recording setups that you can have and walk into. And I got to tell you, sometimes for me, I think it doesn't necessarily change the way the talent performs all that much. I think the talent's the talent, but it really makes a difference between the high-end talent. If you're going to go from, okay, I can do it this good, but with all these other resources, I might be able to do it even 10% better is a big difference. You know, that's where I see some of
that's
those.
That's what we're striving for, that extra 10%.
Yeah, that's what it doesn't necessarily make the talent sound like, you know, the Britney Spears all of a sudden, if they're not like able to perform that way.
Yeah.
But that little extra 10% sometimes could go the long way.
Yeah, I mean, really, when you get down to it, recording studios, you know, the gear does one thing, but it's mostly about the acoustics.
Yeah.
And when you record at home, the acoustics are a problem. Or, you know, like somebody in the film brought up, Steve Higdon, that, you know, we have to contend with the HVAC kicking on, or it's raining, or all these different factors, or a truck goes by, or whatever. You know, when you're in a studio, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. It's just not, it's out of your mind.
Didn't Boston record their first album in a garage or something like that?
I think so. Yeah. And there's all kinds of examples of that, you know, like Foo Fighters, they did, Wasting Light in Dave Grohl's garage and things like that. You know,
granted,
Dave Grohl had a lot more expensive gear to record than most people do, but.
What are some of the famous celebrity studios? Like, didn't Johnny Cash have one, or like some of the high-end ones?
Well, the, you know, Electric Lady is one of the big ones. It was kind of built around Jimi Hendrix, and you know, Prince has Paisley Park.
Oh, Prince, that's right.
What other? Oh, the guys from Stone Temple Pilots have one. I think it's called the Bomb Shelter, I believe.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, so many people, if they got the money, they're gonna build their own place. You know, even if you don't have tons of money, lots of people like to, you know, I'm recording constantly.
Yeah.
I'm gonna put my own place together. It's pretty common.
Oh yeah. You mentioned that Gateway Sound. That was the title when you debuted it here at the film festival in St. Louis. But you said that could be changing. Have you figured out what the name's going to be yet?
Yeah, so Recording in Progress.
No,
it's,
I like
it's kind of a, you know, double meaning. You know, it's that's a common phrase when you walk into a studio and you see a sign. It's, you know, it says Recording in Progress.
Yeah.
But it's also like the progress of recording over time and where the music business is at and all that.
So I know people are going to want to check out Recording in Progress or Gateway Sound if they missed it already, where you were able to do the screening. They're going to have to wait a little bit, but if they want to check you out on the web, I know you have a website, or if they want to check out more about your recording studio, where can they find out more about you?
So the film is at gatewaysoundfilm.com.
Mm-hmm.
And my personal website is glitchfactor.com, and then the studio I work at is smithlee.com.
Gotcha. Smith Lee. Where's it located?
Maplewood.
Oh,
right.
Cool.
Around Big Bend in Manchester, so it's a nice central location.
Cool. Very nice.
Yeah.
Do you allow smoking in there?
No smoking.
Not like the
there.
Old time.
No.
I don't smoke anyway.
No, smoking's not good for the gear.
Yeah, that's the same thing with the radio stations. There was a time where people would smoke in the studios. You'll never see that again.
Yep.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in, Justin L. Fisher, in case people do look you up. You don't want to be confused with any other
All
Justin
those other
Fishers.
Justin Fishers.
Yeah, Justin L. Fisher. Gateway Sound was the name of the documentary, but look for its new title, Recording in Progress. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click On Demand.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.